Why the Public Square Needs Christianity, Progressivism, Joyfully Lutheran, Planned Parenthood, The Lord's Supper, The Hippocratic Oath, Lutheran Education, Christian Hope. Some of your favorite guests will address these topics at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. The one and only 2019 Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here with leaders from across the country and all around the world who are all united by a shared belief in the glory of God and the power of prayer.
I believe that God is love, which is more accurate than saying that love is God. God is the epitome of love. He defines what love is.
No, not so, dear brother. I did not point you down that path so that baptism should grant the liberty to sin. Quite the opposite.
To stray from God's created order and God's created design then becomes a direct attack on the triune God of love in whose image we are made.
Southern Illinois bird watchers love Issues, etc.
Like all of our First Amendment freedoms, we tend to take this one for granted. And it isn't until we feel those freedoms threatened that we really start to notice them. We start to notice how pervasive they are in our lives or how they have been curtailed in our lives. Religious freedom is one of those things that we take for granted, but it is without a doubt under attack. No one is saying that religious freedom should be eliminated, but there are many who are saying in one form or another that it ought to be curtailed or even redefined. Maybe religion should be more privatized and have little, if no, place in the public square. That's the suggestion. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Friday afternoon, May the 17th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We'll begin today's show hearing from Mark Hemingway about religious liberty. And then in hour two, we'll look forward to Sunday morning with Dr. Carl Fikencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking about Jesus turning sorrow into joy in John chapter 16. During the next several days, we're going to play recordings from our fall 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. Our first presentation was Making the Case for Religious Liberty with Mark Hemingway. I first met Mark shortly after you guys got married,
yeah.
I believe, and it was in just the weeks, maybe 5-6 days, if I recall, after I got fired by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Right. And, well, if it makes you feel any better, Molly and I were still pretty touch and go at that point in time, too. So.
We were invited to a secret location just to commiserate with some friends, Jeff and I, and we went over to this place and sitting there, I don't think we expected to see either of them, but Mark and Molly were there, and Jeff and I agree with this on this completely. I was completely impressed. We had wondered for years, we'd known Molly for years and wondered what fish she would finally land, and made suggestions, had all kinds of ideas for her. Jeff and I are furious matchmakers for anybody, any single person we find. We immediately put them on the list for marriage. And she'd been on our list for a long time. And when we got an opportunity to meet the man that she'd finally found and landed, we were deeply impressed. Molly's very smart. Very, very smart. And she has met her intellectual equal in her husband.
Mm.
If you've ever heard them together on our program, you know that it's kind of like getting a chance to listen in on a family spat where the subject is Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or the future of America or any other subject political. It's got to be an interesting kitchen table to sit around even when the microphones are not turned on. Mark is senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and he joins us this evening. We're so happy to have him to address the issue of religious liberty and making the case for it. Please give Mark a warm Houston, Texas welcome.
I just wanted to say, first of all, say how grateful I am to be in Houston. Anytime I can get out of Washington, D.C., I'd like to avail myself of that opportunity. It's as bad as you imagine, probably worse. And it is nice to be in a place such as Houston. I had lunch at a taco truck today, so all is right with the world. And further, I just want to say, as you know, a Lutheran, this church's reputation precedes itself. To put it mildly, I've heard so much about this place, and I feel blessed to finally be here for the first time. 2 days ago, I was at my daughter's third-grade parent-teacher conference with one Anastasia Crumweedy, named Murray, Pastor Scott Murray's daughter, who's my daughter's third-grade teacher at our Lutheran Classical School. So I can certainly attest to the good work and good people that this church produces. Also, I just want to say again, I am really happy to be here at an Issues Etc. conference. I've appeared on the show I don't know how many times at this point in time. Todd and Jeff are some of my favorite people, and despite that warm welcome I got here, our relationship largely consists of passive-aggressive ribbing, which I think is the foundation of all good Lutheran male relationships. But in general, I cannot say enough good things about the valuable work that Todd and Jeff are doing and all of the Issues Etc. crew. I'm going to be talking about this right now, shortly, the value of communicating the gospel and other important, you know, religious ideas to people, and getting these things out into the public square. And nobody does that better than Issues Etc. And whenever I meet another person that tells me that they know me from Issues Etc. or they listen to Issues Etc., I feel like one of those ancient Christians, you know, who's like scratching cymbals in the dirt, you know, to, you know, make my presence known. You know, we're all on the same wavelength here. And that is a wonderful feeling. And to be in a room full of this many Issues Etc. Listeners is, well, I feel really blessed right now. I'm really glad to be here. Now, with all that said, I'm a bit under the weather. I'd like to use that as an excuse. It will shortly become obvious for a myriad of reasons why, of the two Hemingways that are here, I'm not the one on television. Maybe if Jeff had provided the smoke machine that I requested, this would be a little more entertaining. I'll see what I can do here. If I get ahead of myself and otherwise sound like a car crash of dependent clauses, well, just hang in there. It's a lot of information ahead, and feel free to prod me afterward if you see me around. So making things even worse than that, I have been asked to speak about the bleak state of religious liberty in this country. Let me just say that if you want someone to lie to you about what's happening out of a fervent desire to be uplifting at all costs, I suppose your twisted version of the good news would be that Joel Osteen's church is a short drive from here. However, the only real good news here is fortunately the greatest consolation of all, and that is that the gospel of Jesus Christ will be our reward if we labor faithfully in the face of ongoing governmental oppression. Okay, have I adequately lowered the bar enough for this speech? Bad speaker, depressing topic. Okay, good. Now I can tell you that I'm hopeful for one really basic reason. Religious liberty is a topic that, even though it has loomed fairly large in the courts and in the public debate, almost no one understands it, despite using it as a pretext to shove bigotry at every opportunity. It's been presented in an incredibly disingenuous fashion at every turn. And I do believe that getting a critical mass of people to actually understand this issue could flip the issue in our favor almost overnight. And there's a lot of obstacles to that, but I do believe that. And when I talk about the need for people to understand what's going on, I'm not just talking about getting Christians to wake up. I've had dozens of encouraging conversations with secular liberals about this issue. In fact, in the summer of 2016, I was at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, in my capacity as a journalist, and I was at a Bernie Sanders counter protest because they were protesting Hillary Clinton getting the nominee, in part because, as we recently learned, the Democratic primary was in fact rigged. And I was speaking to a guy who was a hardcore Bernie Sanders supporter from Eugene, Oregon. I'm also from Oregon, and we got to talking about this bakery in the suburbs of Portland that had been fined $135,000 by Oregon's Department of Labor for not making wedding cakes for a same-sex commitment ceremony. And And again, I mean, this guy could not have been, you know, more far left. I mean, there were people that were like literally Antifa protesters at this event. And I spent a lot of time talking to this guy about it. And it was amazing. It wasn't even like a difficult conversation. Once I actually explained to this guy, I said, look, these people are not, you know, issuing some blanket ban on gay people walking into their store. They just simply don't want to have to make, you know, cakes for a private religious ceremony that they think is, you know, personal religious significance to them. Like, immediately the guy was like, oh, well, that seems perfectly reasonable. I don't know why we can't accommodate that. But even that simple message is not getting through. And we have to be the people, I'm afraid, that are going to be, you know, carrying this message forward, because, you know, you're not necessarily going to get this in the news media. And so now that you understand how critical it is that the issue is properly understood and presented, let me also note one other really important thing, which is that religious liberty is the foundational liberty for all forms of free expression. Without religious liberty protected both in law and in spirit, the First Amendment is a dead letter. And as a result of that, it is vital to understand that the attack on religious liberty is ultimately about political control. It's an unholy admixture of political correctness and bureaucratic imperatives. There's a growing governmental and political infrastructure dedicated to curtailing basic rights for whom Christian bakers and florists are just the tip of the spear. And there's already mountains of evidence that this infrastructure won't just be used to persecute allegedly bigoted Christians, but it will be used to go after everyone who is speaking out against those in power. So, on the issue of religious liberty being foundational of all people, my wife, imagine that, wrote a very good article on this. And she makes a really interesting point, especially coming from me, who I was a journalism major in college. I spent a lot of time studying this, the sort of American conceptions of freedom of speech and how it relates to the media and how these issues, you know, are presented. And there's this particular issue with media on this topic of religious liberty, where they do a lot of chest thumping about freedom of speech because it's a right that they exercise a lot, and they could care less about religious freedom, to the point where they now regularly engage in the obnoxious practice of putting religious liberty in scare quotes when they write it. However, there's a reason why free exercise of religion and not speech is the first thing mentioned in the First Amendment. It used to be widely understood in this country that those two rights were codependent. If you ever study libel law, and you know this comes up when you're a journalist, as you might imagine, one of the things you learn about is the 1735 trial of John Peter Zanger. It was a libel case against a New York newspaper publisher, and it has long been cited as a massive influence on the American conception of free speech, even though it technically predates the existence of the country. It was so impactful that if you've ever heard the phrase "truth is a defense against libel," that's because it comes from this case of the John Peter Zanger case. However, while that seems like a pretty cut and dried sentiment, it actually hangs on the much more difficult question of what is truth. In the John Peter Zanger case, they arrived at the conclusion that when it came to opinions and other matters that weren't grounded in hard facts, determining truth was actually a religious question, and one that was best left up to individuals. The logical and once widely understood inference being that if you restricted people's ability to practice their religion and express their beliefs, well, then that was an obvious attempt to control what people said about other matters. Understanding this definition of truth was also crucial for the American conception of journalistic objectivity, which was very different than the overtly partisan conception of journalism in Europe. If you believe in free speech, if you believe that free speech and understand that it hangs on the ability of individuals to pursue truth in differing ways, then you have an obligation to present both sides of contentious matters fairly as possible. Of course, this was always a very difficult thing to do in practice, but it was a very useful ideal. I think that all the recent yelping about fake news has given us a pretty good glimpse of the problems that arise as journalism becomes more partisan.
We're listening to Mark Hemingway making the case for religious liberty at our fall 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference on this Friday afternoon. When we come back, what happens when religion enters the debate Mark was just talking about?
Many patients are upset to learn that doctors don't take the Hippocratic Oath anymore.
National Review columnist Wesley Smith talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That's a real shame because the Hippocratic Oath protects patient safety. The speech I will give at the conference will describe the consequences of violating Hippocratic values in healthcare and the things that can occur in the healthcare system if we move away from Hippocratic medicine to a more utilitarian bioethics.
You can meet and hear Wesley Smith making the case for the Hippocratic Oath at the one and only 2019 Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Discover a truly Lutheran approach to education. Concordia University Chicago's Center for the Advancement of Lutheran Liberal Arts supports a vibrant, growing community of classical educators. Whether you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or homeschooler, we have the resources and contacts you need to start a child's journey into the Lutheran liberal arts. Visit cuchicago.edu/calla. That's C-A-L-L-A.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We are listening to Mark Hemingway's presentation at the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas, making the case for religious liberty. The one and only 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference begins 3 weeks from today in Chicago. It's an opportunity for you to hear and meet Matt Walsh of The Daily Wire, Carol Tobias of National Right to Life, Ross Douthat of The New York Times, LCMS President Matt Harrison, Pastor Hans Feeney of Lutheran Satire, Wesley Smith of National Review, and LCMS Worship Director Will Whedon. Registration is $125. That includes 3 meals. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org. The 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Next, we're going to hear from Mark Hemingway on what happens when religion enters the debate.
Now, imagine how utterly disingenuous it is to take this objective model of journalism where we're supposed to be presenting two sides of the issue equally fairly and try and have a hot-button debate about religion itself where you avoid acknowledging this notion of individual pursuit of truth. To understand how this applies specifically to the religious liberty debate, I'm going to rely on there's this smart Christian blogger named John Swearens, and Swearens developed something he calls the Oopsie model of journalism. Oopsie is actually an acronym of 4 O's and PSI, and it looks something like this. So the first O stands for opportunity. So first we need a hot button event that is a proper catalyst for, say, a news cycle. Think Chick-fil-A, you know, Hobby Lobby, Susan G. Komen, you know, any of the big religious liberty issues that have been in the news. Next, you have outrage. So those on the opposite side of the culture wars make a lot of noise about fairness and bigotry and tolerance. Maybe they have a point or maybe they don't, but it's an important step here in the news cycle. Then you have opposition. The national media then, by and large, adopts the definitions brought to them by the outraged. For example, they have no problem identifying religious freedom legislation as anti-gay without the scare quotes. And then at the same time, they put religious liberty in scare quotes. Such labeling and such presentation issues is always a tremendous victory for the outraged. Then we get to the part where we have oversimplification. As part of its coverage, the media fails to cover any sort of nuanced presentation of the debate or closely examine the actual facts of being what's being argued, and preferring to cover it sort of as a horse race between two competing interests sort of beating each other up. Next, we have overreach. At some point, the mainline media will get too cocky and will go a step too far in its boosterism in a way that will be obvious, and other media will sort of point this out and shrink back momentarily in embarrassment. And then we have the pendulum. This is the P now. We're out of the O's. We, prompted by this misstep, a few media commentators will sort of, you know, do some chin stroking and maybe publish a thoughtful analysis piece that asks if everyone is being, you know, are we being too hard on these people that are being accused? You know, are these, you know, just, you know, decent Christians? Now, they still ultimately come to the conclusion that the accused is wrong, but, you know, maybe we can be nicer about it. Finally, we get to silence. After the coverage ceases, we move on to something else. And then we get to introspection, like maybe months later after, like, there's been some, it's obvious there's been some gross miscarriage of justice on a Sunday news program or something. Journalists will gather and ruminate about how they unfairly overstated one side of the debate and pledge to do better next time. And of course, they never do. The cycle repeats itself. And frankly, we're getting to a place where I'm not even sure we get to the overreach or the introspection parts anymore. Okay, so now we have some idea of why this is important. Let's look at the issue of how these assaults on religious liberty are being enforced. With that in mind, let me tell you a story about a personal friend of mine, a guy named Tony. Tony runs a bar in Washington, D.C. Now, before, I would call Tony my bartender once upon a time. I'm a little older now. I don't spend as much time haunting bars as I used to. But, you know, my wife and I knew him reasonably well. He tended a bar in our neighborhood. Anyway, he opened up his own bar on H Street in Washington, D.C. And I'm not making this up. Tony has a big lit up sign above his door that says, "All are welcome here." And I don't know how many of you remember Marion Barry. He was the former mayor of D.C. who got caught smoking crack by the FBI and managed to get reelected after that. Not only to get reelected as mayor after that, he continued on to the city council for several years until he died a few years ago. And anyway, Marion Barry was notorious for sort of shooting his mouth off and saying, like, really unfortunate things. One day while Marion Barry was touring part of Ward 8 of Washington, D.C., the part of the city where he is was the city councilman at the time. And he said in front of TV cameras, this is an exact quote, "We've got to do something about these Asians coming in and opening up businesses and dirty shops. They ought to go. I'm going to say that right now." And that is a direct quote of what the man said. Barry's remark obviously brought widespread condemnation, but less than 3 weeks later, Barry was in trouble again for making racial remarks about Asians. "If you go to the hospital now, you'll find any number of immigrants who are nurses, particularly from the Philippines," said Barry. "And no offense, but let's grow our own teachers, let's grow our own nurses, so we don't have to go scrounging in our community clinics and other kinds of places, having to hire people from somewhere else." No less than the Philippine ambassador to the United States felt compelled to respond to Barry and condemn the remarks. Now, this is where my buddy Tony comes in. My buddy Tony runs a bar. He's sort of an irreverent sort. He's a 6-foot-tall, sandy blonde Irish guy, and you would never know it by looking at him, but it turns out his grandfather is a full-blooded Filipino World War II vet. So my buddy Tony started serving a drink in his bar called Marion Barry's Dirty Asian Summer Punch. Within 48 hours, a member of the D.C. Human Rights Council, a representative of the D.C. District of Columbia Office of Human Rights, walked into his bar called The Pug and handed Tony a letter that began, "It was brought to the attention of the D.C. Office of Human Rights on September 5th, 2012, that your establishment, The Pug, was displaying a racially offensive sign which advertised a cocktail for customers' purchase. Specifically, the sign stated," and this is my favorite part, they misspelled Marion Barry, "stated Marion Barry's Dirty Asian Summer Punch. Below the wording was displayed a caricature of an individual with slanted eyes and protruding teeth. We believe that such a sign is not demonstrative of the shared values and practices that make the district a fully inclusive environment for all residents and visitors. Additionally, we believe the statement violates the D.C. Human Rights Act." So Tony, being Tony, fired up a response to Gustavo Velasquez, the director of the D.C. Office of Human Rights, saying, I received your warning and I fully intend to take the sign down, but is there any way you can send me a copy of the letter you sent Marion Barry after he made his comments about Asians? I believe Barry's comments would fall under the umbrella of making certain people feel, quote, objectionable, unwelcome, unacceptable, or undesirable. Not surprisingly, a copy of no such letter was addressed to Barry has been forthcoming. I should also mention that the letter that was addressed to Tony came with a significant financial penalty. They said if he did not take the letter down within, signed down within four or five days, he would be subject to like an $8,000 fine. He runs an all-cash business. It was, you know, he had no choice, essentially, in the matter, even though he protested. So he didn't take the sign down right away. And a day later, a member of the D.C. Liquor Control Commission was in his bar threatening to shut him down on the spot if he didn't take the sign down. So why am I telling you this story? Well, that's because in nearly every major dispute involving religious liberty cases in the United States, they involve local and state human rights commissions. Nearly every decent-sized town in America has one anymore, and almost every state has one at some level. They are sort of a hodgepodge of, you know, bureaucratic matter, bureaucratic rules and things. Typically, the way that these things are set up, you basically have no opportunity whatsoever to protest, even in like the case of Tony, where, you know, you could have the most just case in the world, for a variety of reasons. One is that the way they set up their own little tribunals, basically, that are sort of extrajudicial and administrative, which means that they are both the prosecutor and the judge. So they basically pay for the prosecution of a complaint against someone at the same time they're sitting in judgment of you. Meanwhile, this is a serious matter involving significant financial penalties, so you have to provide your own legal counsel that you have to pay for if you've been accused. And then on top of that, the way that the federal law is written, there was a Supreme Court case in the late 1980s involving a Christian school, of all things, in the state of Ohio that was basically settled, I can't remember the name of the case, but the legal term of art now is that they refer to it as the Younger abstention, which basically the case concluded that you could have the most brazen, you know, First Amendment violation or Bill of Rights violation in the world, and the Supreme Court and federal courts aren't even going to take up the case until you exhaust everything at the local and state level in terms of procedure.
We're listening to Mark Hemingway, a Washington, D.C. journalist for 20 years, making the case for religious liberty at the 2017 Houston Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. On the other side of the break, how complaints fare in the courts. Nadia Bolz Weber calls for a sexual reformation in her latest book, Shameless. How does her reformation compare with the truths rediscovered during the 16th century Reformation? I've written a review of Shameless in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button on the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Andrew Abraham details his journey from Catholic priest to Lutheran pastor. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Thank you. If you're looking for a good Lutheran church in Scarsdale, New York, one that has sound teaching based on the Word of God and takes pride in the confessions, look no further than Trinity Lutheran Church in Scarsdale, New York, where every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. we have Bible study and Sunday school, followed by the service at 10. Again, good liturgical confessional worship by the grace of God. Find us at trinityscarsdale.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Mark Hemingway, a Washington, D.C. journalist for 20 years, making the case for religious liberty. Next up, how do complaints regarding religious liberty fare in the courts?
Now, obviously, at the time, this was thought of as a way of keeping federal courts from being swamped with penny ante complaints. But over time, as we see with these human rights complaints, what this functionally means is that you can draw out these cases for unbelievable amounts of time just to make people buckle under administrative pressure. There's a case up in New Jersey where I think it was a Methodist church had a piece of property along the Jersey Shore, it was sort of a Christian retreat type thing, and they had three sanctuaries on their property, and this I don't think gay marriage was legal in the state at the time. They had a lesbian couple asked to do a same-sex commitment ceremony there, and they actually said, sure, you can do the commitment ceremony on a property, you just can't do it in any one of our three, you know, sanctuaries that we consider, you know, sacred. And so they got sued by the Human Rights Commission. Just getting through the Human Rights Commission administrative process before they got into an actual court of law took 5 years. Then ultimately, I believe that at the state level, the Human Rights Commission stripped them of their tax-exempt status. I don't know where the current state of that is. But I mean, the point is it's not good. You can see where the administrative hurdles for this sort of thing quickly become extremely problematic. There's both good and bad news, which is that I should also add that there's only one case that I know of where one of these complaints against the Civil Rights Commission has been brought into state court and one at the local level, and that involves a guy named Blaine Adamson who runs a printing company in Kentucky called Hands on Originals, and he didn't want to print T-shirts for a gay rights parade. He's a very Christian man. He doesn't print all manner of messages on things that he deems offensive. He finally did get into state court, and he won at the state court level, although it's still being appealed. But that was a special case because a lot of that case hinged around the idea that the courts could not get around the fact that the man owned a literal printing press. Whereas we'll see later on, in some of these cases, I'm going to get to here shortly, that it quickly becomes a much more complicated issue. So the good news and the terrifying news is that there's a case that's going to be argued before the Supreme Court here, pretty shortly, I think, involving a man named Jack Phillips, who I've met in a number of times. In fact, I was at his bakery in the Denver suburbs this summer. And Jack Phillips is a baker who, again, Same story we've seen with other bakers. He didn't want to bake cakes for a gay wedding. And he has finally gotten his case before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will decide whether or not, basically, that he can abstain from serving these couples. It's kind of a complicated issue in the sense that he considers himself, and this is also true of florists and wedding photographers and a lot of other professions, to be what they call a creative professional. So in the case of Jack, you know, he's a cake decorator. I mean, he started out, he was trained as an artist. If you see him paint cakes, I mean, he's got paintbrushes actually behind the counter, and he paints these cakes and does these landscapes and all these other things. And the argument is effectively that, you know, these people are functionally artists, and you can't tell people what art they can or can't create. The countermanding argument is that this is a matter of public accommodation, which is that all the public accommodation laws popped up in sort of the wake of the civil rights era, because there was a lot of widespread discrimination involving businesses. But in public accommodation was typically meant to apply toward things like lunch counters in hotel rooms, where you're serving the same product to every person regardless. It's not the same thing as doing a custom piece of artwork or a custom cake. I mean, as you know, if you tune on the Food Network, you know, they have cake baking competitions where people, you know, see who can be the most artistic of these, you know, big ornate things. And that is where that is what the Supreme Court is going to be deciding on. The good news is that if the Supreme Court rules the right way on that case, it should clear up a lot of these issues and will be very helpful. The bad news is that if the Supreme Court decides that this is a matter of public accommodation and you must be forced to basically serve anyone that comes to your door, I mean, it's going to be basically Katie bar the door. It will become extremely difficult to practice any sort of Christian principles consistently in the public square. And I mention this because I do not think the Christian church in America has even begun to think about the consequences of what that will mean, what the response should be, because this will be an incredible watershed moment. I mean, the effects won't be felt overnight, but I mean, very quickly you might start to see a big clampdown on being Christian in public. But I also just want to add again that this, you know, bring this back again, this all started because the Colorado Civil Rights Commission decided to go after this guy, who, by the way, is the sweetest, most good-natured man you've ever met, and one of the most sincere Christians you'll ever meet. It's not just that he doesn't bake, you know, cakes for gay weddings. He doesn't make Halloween cakes. That's how Christian he is. He does not, you know, he's been asked to turn down all manner of things. He's asked to make divorce cakes. He doesn't turn down. He's asked to make cakes insulting gay people. He turned that down. He just is a man of very sincere Christian conviction, and I hope the courts see that. However, again, getting back to these bureaucratic star chambers, that's not the way that things have been presented. And in fact, in their ruling against Jack Phillips, the Colorado Civil Rights Commissioner, Diane Rice, wrote in saying, in her decision against him, freedom of religion and religion, I love how she conflates those two things, freedom of religion and religion has been used to justify all kinds of discrimination throughout history, whether it be slavery, whether it be the Holocaust, whether it be, we can list hundreds of situations where the freedom of religion has been used to justify discrimination. Not only is that not true, I just want to add that, and this gets Jack very upset, Jack's father was one of the soldiers in World War II that liberated Buchenwald. So to say that he is perpetuating the Holocaust has been deeply personally hurtful to him, but this is the level of nuance and understanding we are dealing with when it comes to the sort of, you know, bureaucrats that think that they are striking a blow for the forces of equality. Anyway, I don't really have a way out of that. It's like I warned you, this would be bleak.
We're listening to Mark Hemingway from the 2017 Houston Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, making the case for religious liberty on this Friday afternoon. On the other side of the break, what if we win in the courts, but we lose in the court of public opinion? LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces is committed to serving those who serve. Find out more about their Ministry by Mail program, which sends spiritual resources, including portals of prayer, to military members. LCMS.org/armed forces. LCMS.org/armed forces. Are you looking for a First Communion, Confirmation, or Graduation gift? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is the new bonded leather cover edition of Luther's Small and Large Catechisms. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 and request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Martin Luther's Small and Large Catechisms, 1-800-325-3040.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. During May, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their Ministry of the Month, Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armedforces.
I believe in the Holy Spirit. Christians confess these words each week during the Divine Service. But have you ever wondered, who is the Holy Spirit? Join Curtis Giese, Jeffrey Oswald, Charles Geeshan, and others in the May issue of the Lutheran Witness as they consider the person and work of the Holy Spirit. Special highlights include a Bible study by Matt Richard and an original Pentecost hymn text by Mark Preuss. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We are listening to Mark Hemingway, Make the Case for Religious Liberty, from the 2017 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Houston, Texas. So the question remains, what if we win in the courts but lose in the court of public opinion?
I just wanted to say that the big thing to sort of keep in mind here, though, is that it doesn't really matter if we win the legal debate but lose the culture war. You know, I mean, we have to be, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of attention focused on the legal proceedings and all of these things that I've explained to you. There are some great Christian legal groups, the Beckett Fund, Alliance Defending Freedom. They're doing yeoman's work on these issues, and have actually been quite successful in the courts on these issues. But the fact of the matter is that we're sort of losing the cultural consensus on this. On one hand, I think we as Lutherans of all people should understand this, you know, well. I mean, we all, Lutherans, you know, all ended up in this country because we were being, you know, forced to pray with Calvinists by the state, and we didn't want that, so we all came to America, right? You know, we've always had this attitude, I think, more so than other church bodies, that we cannot depend on the state or any sort of, you know, cultural consensus to protect our beliefs and our way of life, and that is why, you know, we've retained tight-knit communities, why we were, you know, still saying, you know, the liturgy in German, you know, in the World War II. These things have, you know, largely protected us. But I think the larger body of American Christendom really took for granted this really anomalous thing that happened sort of in post-war America, where there was this sort of like middle-class Judeo-Christian grand consensus, everything where it was very sort of culturally homogenized for this window of time where, you know, there was a lot of cultural optimism and, you know, America seemed to be mostly on the move with a few minor hiccups. And so people came to trust that this Judeo-Christian consensus would hold. And the reality is we need to wake up to this now, and we should have been aware of it all along, is that that kind of consensus that is protecting the church is always going to be ultimately very fleeting. So with that in mind, I mean, I already mentioned the case of the baker in Oregon that I was talking about the guy in the Democratic Convention with, but I want to bring up this story. So there was a bakery in the suburbs of Portland, Oregon. Now, I don't know if you know much about what's been happening in Portland, Oregon the last 10 years or so. it has basically turned into San Francisco North. I grew up in Oregon. I mean, it was always kind of a liberal city, but I mean, what's gone on in Portland is it's just truly, utterly insane politically. I mean, the sex scandals in that town you just would not believe. I mean, you know, we've been talking about the Senate candidate in Alabama. The mayor of Portland and the governor was sleeping with a 14-year-old babysitter for years, and everyone from the sheriff of Multnomah County on down covered up for him. There's been this sort of like, I don't know, this liberal enclave that's developed around the city, and it's really becoming a situation here where when you see how this plays out, how we've gone from a situation here where, you know, we were trusting this Judeo-Christian consensus to a situation where now we have this, you know, sort of poisonous secular liberal consensus that is, you know, very anti-Christian. So anyway, with that in mind, this couple, they ran a bakery in the suburbs of Portland in a very liberal area. And they decided they were going to be good Christians and they were not going to serve. Again, gay marriage was not yet legal in Oregon, gay commitment ceremonies at the time. And so this lesbian couple came in, they got reported. Within months, their business was shut down. And, you know, you can complain all you want about the legal unfairness of this. It got really bad. I mean, I think 18 months after the business was shut down, the Oregon Labor Department came in with a $135,000 fine. At that point in time, I believe the husband who ran the business with his wife was collecting trash to support his family. And they still came in with a $135,000 fine. Now, you can protest the legal unfairness, they should have the right to do this and all these other things, but it doesn't matter if the people in the community don't want that. You know, if they are going to be completely intolerant and unsupportive, then there's nothing that we can do. You can have all the laws in the books that you want. People are not going to patronize that business. People are not going to be allowed to speak openly about and profess their faith, and that is where the real problem is. So I guess what I would say now about that is, this is the tricky part, is, well, what can be done? I mean, I said I'm not terribly optimistic. I mean, I do think that people can be reached on this issue. The thing is far from gone. I mean, I do think that we have this horribly asymmetric media situation that makes it very difficult for us to go out in mass and sort of, you know, address these issues one-on-one with every American so they understand the complexities of everything I've just laid out to you. I mean, this is not a simple matter in many respects. But I do think that it is important to remember that, you know, Lutherans were called the original evangelicals for a reason. We are Lutherans, and if there are any of you who are, you know, confessional Protestants generally, I know that a lot of you do listen to issues, etc. We are very uniquely positioned in this country to address these sort of conflicting issues between faith and government. Because I go to church in the D.C. area, we get a lot of chaplains that come through my congregation, and it's fascinating to me that they end up being leaders on a lot of the new Pentagon policy that's coming out, involving all the transgender stuff and all the other things the military is grappling with that are related to this. And it's pretty obvious to me why, which is that as confessional Lutherans, we are really well positioned to articulate these issues in public life because we have a good grasp of systematic principled theology. So we can essentially speak Catholic, as it were. And at the same time, we're not Catholic in crucial respects. So we have the credibility to speak to mainline Protestants and evangelicals whose churches might otherwise seem so politicized that they'd be unhelpful wading into the culture war with their understanding as they see it. So I guess what I would say to you all is, despite this not being a very sort of pretty picture, the fact that you're all listening to issues, et cetera, and getting a good grasp of these issues and coming here today is a wonderful thing. And I hope that you understand that, you know, when you listen to issues, et cetera, it's not just about getting yourself informed. It is an opportunity to go out there and inform other people. about what's going on. I mean, the whole idea here is that this has got to have as, you know, wide a reach as possible. I do think that, you know, we can make significant progress on the issue of religious liberty if we just go out and tell our friends and neighbors about it. You know, if I can convince, you know, a Bernie Sanders supporter, you know, who's hobnobbing with a bunch of Antifa protesters at the Democratic Convention, that religious liberty is in his best interest, you know, you can convince darn near anybody. I take that back. The only time I've had a really unpleasant conversation about the topic was when I asked a guy who worked for the ACLU why they completely flipped their position on religious freedom laws. But it can be done. I mean, I think even the ACLU is not entirely beyond hope. But again, thank you very much, and I would just encourage you to take everything you've learned this weekend, everything you've learned from issues, et cetera, and go out there and make sure that, you know, it doesn't just, you know, stay in your earphones when you're in the podcast at the gym or when you're sitting around the table listening with your family. It needs to get out there into the wider world and outside of our churches and in our homes. Thank you.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is a 2-volume, single-bound book. You're familiar with both of them. It's Martin Luther's Small and Large Catechisms. To my knowledge, this may be the first time in English that these two volumes have ever been bound together for the reader to use and to utilize both in their learning and their devotional life. Find out more about Martin Luther's Small and Large Catechisms at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Next hour, we'll look forward to Sunday morning, talking with Dr. Carl Fakencher about Jesus turning sorrow into joy in John chapter 16.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
What makes Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois so special? Our new members talk about the family atmosphere, the welcoming people, and the outstanding music. But most importantly, you'll be confronted with your sin and comforted with the assurance that Jesus has removed that sin so that you can live each day as His baptized and forgiven child. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is at 612 North State Street in Freeburg, Illinois. Sunday worship is at 9 a.m., Sunday school and Bible classes at 10:20 a.m. Call 618-539-5664.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.
Be strong and courageous from Joshua 1:9 is the theme for the 41st academic year at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment and provide an alternative to secular public high schools. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the giving page or call me, Dr. Jay Krause, principal at 618-656-0043.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Do you long for a church where the gospel of the sinner's free justification is front and center, and yet where a robust sacramental life is confessed and lived? Do you long for a church that rejoices in the sacred scriptures as the sole basis for the church's teaching and proclamation, yet values and listens to the witness of the ancient fathers and councils? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We are what you've been looking for. Find a Christ-centered, cross-focused church near you on the Find the Church page at issuesetc.org.
We're joined now by listener Rocky. Rocky, tell us about the tax benefits of donating stocks to Issues, etc.
What we discovered in talking with our tax people and our stock advisors is that it would be beneficial for us to be giving our charitable donations by this means, by giving stocks, which meant that we could give a stock and essentially say if you gave a $100 stock, it's straight money to whatever charitable organization you want to give. As opposed to cashing it out, we'd only be able to give whatever portion is left over after the tax consequences.
How would you advise our listeners if they're interested in donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds?
They need to go and talk to their stockbroker or their tax person, and I think they'll find out it makes a heck of a lot of economic sense. And you're much better steward with your money, because what you're ending up doing is stretching the dollars that you're able to give donation-wise, and you're able to give a whole lot more directly to those people that you want to support, and you're able to preserve much more for yourself using the laws that have been provided for it.
Rocky, is there anything that we left out that you want to tell our listeners?
Well, the only thing that you've missed is that people really need to support Issues, etc. This is a terrific way to do it in a very economical way. It's a way to do it and be good stewards of the resources that God has blessed people with. And I would encourage everyone to support Issues, etc. in every possible way that they can. And if this is available to them, I'd encourage them to look into it, because it not only will help them, but it'll help Issues, etc. also.
To find out how to reduce your tax burden and support this worldwide outreach by donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds, talk to your stockbroker or tax advisor, and then call Craig here at Lutheran Public Radio, 618-223-8385.